A dark-skinned boy runs into a crystal-blue sea. A man in a suit hands his passport to a ticket agent. The boy leaps from the water with a shell in his hand. A plane lifts into a powder-blue sky. A young woman sits cross-legged on the sand, boring a hole in the shell. More shells lie in a pile at her feet. She and the boy turn at the sound of a motor. It is the man in the suit, speeding over the waves in a powerboat. The boat runs up on the beach. The boy leads the man to the spot where the woman sits. The man opens his briefcase and takes out a thread. The woman smiles and begins to string the shells onto it. Agron Torabundo, a voiceover says. Not global. Planetary.
It's testing really well,
Skylark Fitzgibbon says, folding closed the screen.
In European and American markets?
Be careful what you wish for, isn't that what they say? Ish has got what she wanted. Plans are in motion to save Kokomoko. Already sea walls are being constructed, sand imported to replace what's been taken. This Skylark Fitzgibbon, who emerged from the marketing department last week like a kind of Barbie-shaped airiness, sends us regular updates on the golf course, now to be located at the northern end of the island in an area she refers to variously as almost uninhabited and effectively uninhabited.
One last thing. What do you think those shell necklaces would retail for? I know they're not for sale, but if they were, does $85 sound right? Ballpark?
A paranoid mind might suspect that all of this had been put together specifically to torture Ish. Every email, every peppy chat with Skylark visibly reduces her, as if some verdant last fragment of her own simpler, happier past were being surgically excised. But there is nothing she can do. My computer has been returned. Getting back to work, I find that the world is in its customary state of turmoil. The impending investigation of money laundering by a major British bank is causing havoc in the FTSE. In Greece, a bomb in an Athens bank has killed three tellers, one of them a pregnant woman. Investors respond by buying up German bunds. The euro is in crisis. America is in crisis. The market is on the brink of meltdown yet again, like a hysterical ex-lover who keeps calling you up threatening suicide. Ireland, on the other hand, is weirdly calm. Economically, the situation is worse than ever, but the minister's death seems to have functioned as a kind of pressure valve. Thousands attend the state funeral, and as the encomiums keep coming, public anger is diverted to other less disruptive emotions, pity, guilt, a kind of defanged, non-specific regret. The marches peter out, awkward questions about the Royal Irish report dry up, the abusive calls and sinister black faxes which I had been receiving in a steady stream dwindle almost to nothing. And one morning I arrive at work to find Jürgen standing at the window with a mug of coffee and a contented air, like a man surveying a pile of freshly chopped logs. At first I can't see what's giving him so much satisfaction. Then I realize the key is bare. The zombies are gone. It looks as if the pavement has been scoured to ensure not a trace of them remains, though down in the water fragments of placards, bottles and items of clothing bob forlornly.
Police?
Local people taking matters into their own hands. His smile is as sheer and white as a cliff face. The Irish understand what needs to be done. I think about Ariadne's friend with the dreadlocks, try to summon up some spark of triumph. Nothing comes. Instead, I feel as if she's been banished too, scrubbed away from my world, even though I can see her just about through the dawn-dazed glass of the Ark. Agrobot rampages on. The acquisition of Clearinghouse Parsifal is completed, that of Terra Nova Asset Management almost. Kevin points proudly to a Wall Street Journal article calling the bank omnivorous. An inspirational memo from Porter notes that a stitch in time saves nine. Our subsequent long position in Time Warner, where in a shock move Bastian Stitch is appointed CEO the following week, pays off handsomely. Our stock rises, people revise their bonus expectations upwards, there is talk of moving into a new premises. Champagne is drunk, cigars are smoked, lap dances enjoyed, the rain-logged sky is a rag soaked in chloroform, pressing relentlessly down on the city. Then everything changes. What's this shit? Gary McCrum says, staring at his terminal. No warning, no explanation, just a small but noticeable decline in our share price. Liam English plays it down.
Regression to the mean, that's all. Market valuation's been increasing for 6 months straight. There is bound to be an adjustment sooner or later.
This isn't an adjustment, it's a nosedive. It's not a nosedive, Liam says irritably. He looks off into space, tugs on his tie as though pumping it for information, then concedes.
Look, there's a certain amount of rethinking going on out there about counterintuitiveness. It's the usual story. You do something new, everyone else piles in, there's some bad deals. The market panics. As the originators, we might be carrying the can for more than this fare. It'll pass.
He huffs back to his office and closes the Venetian blind. But through the apertures we detect, or imagine we detect, the blue glow of an electronic cigarette.
He's stonewalling us, Jocelyn Lockhart says. You think something's happening? There's rumours going around.
What sort of rumours?
That we overborrowed to pay for the Agron takeover, that our core assets are overvalued, that we're broke, essentially.
But it's not true, is it?
Kevin says.
It's just some hedge fund taking shots in the dark, Gary McCrum says. Standard trash and cash. Liam's right, it'll burn itself out.
Jocelyn shrugs.
We'll see.
I spend most of the day taking calls from clients and counterparties, listening to casual but pointed inquiries about trades and investments. I assure them that there's nothing to worry about, that it is simply an anomaly, that by tomorrow everything will be back to normal. On the contrary, overnight the temperature becomes a fever, and the next morning the calls begin before I even leave my apartment, slowly but inexorably rising in volume and anxiety over the course of the day, while the bank's share price slowly but inexorably falls. We feel the queries, we soothe the qualms, we placate and mollify to the best of our ability, but as our superiors aren't telling us anything, this doesn't amount to much.
Word is we're over-leveraged.
It's mid-quarter, everyone's over-leveraged.
I heard we couldn't make good on a deal.
That's bullshit.
Don't yell at me, I'm just telling you what people are saying.
Come on, if we decayed on a trade, we know about it. It'll be all over the place. It is all over the place.
I had a customer ask me today if we were still solvent. This is a guy I've traded with for years. I said yes, but I'm not even sure we are.
We are not sure of anything except this. Agrobot is under siege. A strange metaphysical siege in which lies beset truth. The question of who began the attacks very soon becomes unimportant. In the market, it does not take long for rumor to become self-fulfilling. Spread a story, no matter how wild, if even a handful of shareholders believe it and sell their stock, a notional drop in value becomes an actual drop. The false narrative supersedes the true, people panic, the sell-off intensifies, the share price collapses, the hedge fund or whoever was behind the initial short makes a killing. If a company's fundamentals are strong, as ours are, this won't happen. The rumors won't stick, the attacks will abate, the short sellers will give up, look for an easier mark elsewhere. It's only a matter of time. That's what we tell ourselves. That's what we tell our clients. But we can feel the market as never before, a palpable entity delving into our terminals, our trades, our collective past, an invisible hand tapping the walls, looking for the weak spot. I'm in the office till close to midnight trying to talk away client jitters. I'm back again at 6 a.m. doing the same. As the minutes tick towards the opening of the market, the fear mounts, the pressure becomes almost unbearable, a hissing force that pushes against the eyeballs. Events roll silently in a band across the TV. Messages ping onto my computer screen. Joe Peston and Dwayne McGuckian and Mike Purcell iterate numbers into their headsets. The telephones ring and ring and ring. The effort of defending the bank is visible on every face, and although the floor is as noisy as ever, it seems we can hear the silence beneath it, oceanically deep, oceanically cold. And the loudest silence is Porter's. In our hour of need, he seems to have vanished, leaving us with only more conjecture.
I heard he had another heart attack.
I heard his wife tried to commit suicide. He wouldn't stay out of the office for that. If he'd stop whining like little girls for a minute. Dave Davison's bored baritone rises up from behind the divider. Then you'd realize the reason we haven't heard from him is that he already has it covered. We've got an open line of credit with his buddy the Caliph, more than enough to carry us through some market hissy fit.
That's true, but there is a hitch. Following his merciless quashing of the rebellion, the Caliph has been removed by his Imperial Guard to an undisclosed location while the last dregs of the uprising are mopped up.
It's a delicate situation.
Jürgen explains. They are purging his ministries of any suspected sympathizers. For security reasons, the Caliph prefers to monitor this from a distance.
And what about us? He can't even pick up a phone.
It is only a matter of time,
Jürgen says. Others are less optimistic. Someone knows something, Howie says, watching the screen. Someone's got something on us. Business on the 9th floor has stalled. Howie's investors, spooked by the sudden dip in our fortunes, refuse to believe his assurances that the bank and the fund are two separate entities. Some of them are even demanding their money back.
I tell them, how can I give you your money back? I invested it. That's what you paid me to do. It's not like I put it in a suitcase and buried it in the back garden.
He has been down here most of the morning, Chinese wall notwithstanding. He claims he is trying to contain the contamination, though he spends most of his time kicking furniture.
What are the hedge funds saying? I ask him.
They're saying we're fucked, Claude. It's not like it's a secret. People are climbing over each other trying to ditch their stock. Some crowd in California betting a fortune will be gone in less than a week.
Less than a week?
Why not? Bear went under in less than a week. Lehman went in less than a week. They are both much bigger than us.
A chill of silence sweeps through the room, as if a door had been blown open by some soundless storm.
But why is this happening? I say, what is it they think they know?
They know Agrobot's a pissant operation run by people who don't have a bull's notion what they're doing,
Howie returns.
If it did go under,
little Terry Fusco pipes up,
would that mean our shares would be worthless?
It won't go under, Dave Davison insists. I'm telling you, they won't let it. They can't.
Though if it does, Gary McCrum says with a kind of bitter relish, we won't get a penny. We'll be at the end of a long, long line.
Where's Porter?
Kevin cries.
Why doesn't he say something? Why doesn't he do something?
The same questions, the same unsatisfactory answers, hour after hour, like a torturous carousel. And in the background, the edifice we thought indestructible is being steadily and invisibly dismantled, as if by ghosts. By now, most of the calls have dried up. Clients no longer want reassurance. Instead, they seek to put as much distance as they can between them and us. New business is non-existent.
We're like lepers out there,
Howie fumes, sending another wastebasket flying.
We're like grease!
One man remains unafraid of infection. Around lunchtime, Walter's car pulls up outside. He doesn't look like someone whose empire is on the brink of collapsing. Instead, he looks like he's swallowed it whole. He's grown so bloated that to fit in the limo, I have to sit with my knees practically up to my chin. I'm expecting an inquisition about the bank's current performance or a furious command to liquidate his investments, but he doesn't even mention Agrobot's travails, just hands me the usual bundle of checks. Hasn't he heard? Or doesn't he care? Maybe as Walter Corliss, he believes himself immune to the flying grit of circumstance. He writes his own story, which intersects with the wider world's only as and when he desires it. Or maybe he, too, knows something we don't.
Most of our lenders have rolled over the loans we need to keep operating today, Jürgen says.
It is morning, just about. Outside, first light struggles against twisting cords of rain. Jürgen has a curiously antique quality about him, that maniacal energy that comes with lack of sleep.
However, in return, they are seeking significantly more margin, which is proving problematic. We could sell off some bonds in order to raise the cash, but the fear is that this might be interpreted as a sign that we are in trouble.
The market seems pretty clear that we're in trouble, Jürgen.
Yes, however, they don't know yet how much trouble, he says.
Panicked eyes meet in momentary panic embraces.
One of our hedge fund clients has requested we return the cash they have given us to administer,
he explains.
This will leave a serious hole in the bank's balance sheet.
What about the Caliph, the line of credit?
The Caliph remains incommunicado.
His secret service is reporting a security breach, presumably some handful of militants that escaped the bombing. There is no threat to the Caliph himself, but personal access is limited to his Imperial Guard.
We don't want to access him, we just want him to give us some money.
We are monitoring the situation,
Jürgen says. After the briefing, there is nothing to do. All our meetings have been cancelled. No one wants to trade with us. In Limbo, people start acting strangely. Some leave without explanation for long, fugue-like breaks, return muttering to themselves, attended by unfamiliar smells. Others throw their feet up on a desk and make long-distance calls, or sit motionlessly for hours, staring at online poker hands. On the way to the toilet, I encounter Kimberly, the receptionist, emerging furtively from the handicapped stall with Dave Davison, the back of her skirt snarled up in her tights. Who could blame them? As the share price falls and our lives are hollowed out proportionally, I yearn for something physical, a touch of the hand, a smile, anything that could deliver me from all this abstraction. But it feels like the physical world is ever less available, like we're trapped in a car that's plunged into the sea and we can't get the windows to roll down. Then a cry goes up. Porter's making a statement! Instantly a crowd gathers under the big screen, wary faces burnished by hope. Banking being essentially a confidence drink, to insist publicly on your solvency is a risky move. Unless it's pitched exactly right, it could be taken as an admission that the game is up. But this is Porter Blankley. Of course it will be pitched right. Porter will explain everything and we will come back bigger and better than ever. Beleaguered bank, the news anchor is saying. Amid mountain fears of a debt downgrade, at the bottom of the screen, the crawl reads 11% drop in 24 hours. 11%? Someone behind me moans, shh! Don't shush me, I took a loan out to buy those shares. Failed to calm a hostile market, causing an escalating series of margin calls amid speculation that at least one Wall Street firm has refused any further trading with Agron Toribundo, and that restructuring is becoming unavoidable. Fuck you, bitch! Porter's gonna restructure your ugly face! Go live as these questions and others are put to the bank's co-vice president of global equities, George Death. The crowd in front of the TV falls silent. What? Someone says. The picture cuts to a conference room where a very small man is crossing a stage to a lectern. Who the fuck is this guy? Did Porter shrink in the wash? The man has begun to speak. However, only the top of his head is visible over the top of the lectern, and it quickly becomes evident the microphones are too far away to pick up his voice. An aide runs on and frantically begins adjusting the mics. The co-vice president, apparently unaware of any issue, continues to read inaudibly. Muttering can be heard from the unseen press corps. There is a crunch of static. Iterable upside, the top of the co-vice president's head says. That is all I have to say at this time. Thank you, gentlemen. He stumps away from the lectern in a fusillade of flashes and hollering. For a moment, silence. Then, Christ, that's not going to help. Couldn't they have found someone more than 4 feet tall? Couldn't they have found someone whose name isn't Death? Actually, I think it's pronounced Deeth. Oh, great, call the Wall Street Journal. Shares have dropped another 2 points, Gary reports. The room churns with exclamations of gloom until Rachel appears in the doorway, clapping her hands in a teacherly fashion. You heard the co-vice president, she says. The bank is fully capitalized, so please concentrate on your... She pauses as her secretary clatters in at top speed to whisper in her ear. Then, turning pale, she rushes back to her office. A minute later, the news comes across Bloomberg that Agrobot's long and short-term credit rating has been downgraded to junk. The grumbling of a moment ago resolves into a single consensual moan. It might be the bank's death cry.
What's going on?
Kevin asks, tugging my sleeve. I explain that the big institutional investors, the pension funds and so on, are prohibited from putting their money into anything with a rating of BB+ or lower, and so the downgrade means that at the stroke of a pen we have lost most of our lenders, and with them the money we need to do the things we do. It seems I can feel a physical snap, a breaking away, and I go to the window, half expecting to find Transaction House now floating down the Liffey. But of course everything is where it always is. In the lobby, the lift doors hiss open. Brent Crude Kelleher, who, to judge by his jubilant expression, has not heard the latest news, saunters into the office bearing 2 large paper bags.
They're giving away muffins at the hippie place!
In the general indifference, I feel like an icicle has stabbed me in the heart.
Some sort of closing down thing,
Brent says then, clearly troubled by my reaction.
I got one for you, Claude.
I push past him, jab the button for the lift, almost immediately think better of it, and crash down the stairs. Rain is falling again, in dense needles that seem to surround and isolate the people dashing across the plaza like some ingenious, ever-shifting force field, the ultra-fine bars of some imminent cage. After weeks of downpour, floods have beset Dublin. The underground rivers that crisscross beneath the city's foundations have come to the surface and found the plains where they would in the past have dissipated now occupied by the tax relief malls, car parks and apartment blocks of the boom. And the Liffe is rising too. On the far side of the plaza, trash laps the mossy tops of the quays, jackals feeding on the slimy corpse of some enormous beast. In the Ark, it looks like the end of the world is expected any minute. Rain-soaked consumers jostle past each other, deliberately avoiding eye contact, arms loaded with pastries, crepes, organic prune juice. At the counter, the staff have a besieged look. With some difficulty, I elbow my way through to Ariadne.
"Claude!"
she exclaims when she sees me, but in an instant her delight turns to sadness.
"Where have you been?"
she says with an unconcealed note of accusation. "Busy," I say guiltily, and then, "What's happening?"
"Special deal," she says. "Buy anything, get two other things free."
"Some special occasion?" I am praying that Brent has got it wrong. She shrugs fatalistically.
"We are closing."
Nothing changes, but everything does. I feel like an extraterrestrial in a comic book who, looking up at a blank square of sky, knows that his home planet has exploded. I see.
"I have told you the landlord wants to put up the rent, right? So we went to see the bank, but they say there's nothing they can do."
"I can't believe it," I say softly.
"Today's our last day, that's why we get rid of everything. If there's anything you want, just take it, I don't charge you." "What's in there?"
A flurried woman beside me points suspiciously at a wicker tray of buns. I wait while Ariadne explains that these are cinnamon, these pear, these raisin. The woman, still glowering mistrustfully, throws a couple in her basket, then stalks off. Outside, the rain rattles from the overflowing gutters like gunfire. "The Ark is leaving just when we need it most," I say.
"Aye, what can we do? We don't want to close, but it's impossible. I don't know who does the landlord expect to move in and pay his crazy rent, or does he just want to force us out?"
I start to explain the logic of the upward-only rent review, that the value of a building as an asset is based on the rent that could be charged for it, meaning it often makes more sense to keep that rent high and the building unoccupied than to lower the rent and have to mark down its overall. I tail off. Ariadne is gazing at me with a mixture of bewilderment and horror. All I can do even now is parrot the lines of the enemy. What is wrong with me?
"What will you do?" I say quickly. "Where will you go?"
"I don't know yet,"
she reflects.
"Everything happens so quickly. I'd like to stay, but it's hard to find work here, and it's so expensive."
She lets out a heavy, troubled sigh.
"Is people just going to let this happen?"
"You mean the rent review?" Though I know she doesn't.
"I mean everything."
She casts a sallow hand at the window, the waterlogged, debt-laden nation outside.
"It gets worse and worse, and still people just shrug their shoulders. In Greece, in Spain, they're out on the streets. Here, if you go on the streets, they think you're a fool or a criminal, and you deserve whatever you get. What's everyone so afraid of? Why don't they do something if they care?"
As she says this, her eyes swing directly up to meet mine, their challenge so violent that I take an involuntary step backwards. I begin to ask her about her friend the zombie, then realize that the answer, whatever it is, will probably not reflect well on me, so instead I change the subject. "Oscar will go with you if you leave?"
"Of course,"
she says, it seems to me curtly. And then from behind me there comes a crash, and we look over to see that someone has knocked a box of pasta from the shelf. Ariadne groans and fetches a dustpan and brush.
"Mother of Christ, these people,"
she murmurs, kneeling down to sweep up the spilled linguine.
"If any of them have come before today, we wouldn't need to close."
"Why don't you give the food to the shelter?"
"Because it closed too. Last week, Brenda says the government won't give any more money. You know, they have all this bullshit with the banks."
Yes, I say faintly and with a flush of shame. The door opens and closes. The beginnings of the lunch crowd join the pandemonium, a fresh stream of shoulders and elbows bruising their way by.
I must go back to work,
Ariadne says defeatedly. She takes a step into the melee, and it hits me like an axe blow that this is the last time I will see her. There will be no sunsets, no hooting train whistles, no valedictory speeches. I have not earned any of that. She will simply leave the frame and be gone and never be replaced. That's how it works in the real world.
Wait.
She turns, looks at my hand on her sleeve.
Maybe I can do something, I say with a dry mouth. For the cafe, find a backer, negotiate with the landlord for a couple of months, extension, buy some time at least.
Thanks, Claude, she says gently. But I think it's too late.
I know people, I insist, still clutching her arm. I should have thought of it before. I'll go back to the office and make some calls.
Thank you, she repeats.
That's very kind.
Investors are always looking for a good opportunity, I tell her. Forecasts for the service industry are strong. Then take into account footfall in the financial services center and the growing market for specialist foods. On and on I babble with less and less idea what I'm saying, just to keep the conversation alive, to keep her here with me for a few seconds longer, until at last the words run out and I am left gaping at her in silence. Ariadne doesn't move away. Instead, she looks down again at my hand on her forearm, then up again at me. Some invisible veil falls away, and in an instant I see that she has understood everything. Nowhere to hide now. All I can do is pretend I haven't noticed she's noticed, find some trivial remark that will give us both an escape route. But my powers of dissembling have deserted me. Instead, I hang wretchedly in the lamplight of her gaze, like an abject, sodden stranger who appears on the step in the middle of a rainstorm and throws himself on her mercy. Someone is calling her name from behind the till. With a supreme effort, I manage to relinquish her arm, but she stays where she is a moment longer, holding my gaze with strangely liquid eyes.
Goodbye, Claude,
she says at last. Leaning forward, she kisses my cheek. And then she is gone, devoured in the churn of lunchtime vultures. The rest of the day is an unremitting agony. Never has the office seemed so toxic. The bland pastel shirts, the veined mock leather of the desks, the swirling screensavers and bright glowing spreadsheets. These are merely lesser darknesses in a vast and opaque and airless night. A lesson in entropy that is repeated and repeated until it has drummed its emptiness into every cell of my being. The scale of the pain catches me off guard. I thought I'd reconciled myself long ago to being without her. Now I realize that instead of giving her up, my heart had concocted a future in which we could go on, if not together, at least in parallel, that I might continue to love her from a distance. And she would continue to live her life with that love wrapped around her, an unseen protector like an angel's wing. I do my best to keep my promise to her, but with the bank in its current state of public disintegration, pitching an investment is like a poisoner trying to sell cookies door to door. At this stage, most of my contacts don't even answer the phone. There must be something I can do. In a novel, the cafe's rack-renting landlord would turn out to be one of our wicked clients, Walter Corliss, maybe, who for all these years has harbored an irrational hatred of macrobiotic foods and plans to convert the cafe into a car park. I would confront him, and gloatingly he'd reveal to me all of his sinister and illegal business dealings, only to discover that I'd recorded the conversation and thus brought down his whole Babylonian empire. But in the real world, which is the world of business, there are no stories like this, with heroes and villains' motives other than profit. The landlord isn't a person, just the name given to an investment portfolio. The decision was made in the void eye of another hurricane 1,000 miles away, a Canadian pension fund, a German reinsurance firm, an asset management company in Tokyo, Sydney, or Lahore. No one working there will ever have seen the Ark or know anything about it except as a figure on a spreadsheet. The lease is doubtless administered by someone just like me, wishing he was elsewhere, sending off the rote email while dreaming of another waitress in another cafe. Day turns into night. There is nothing to do but we stay at our desks until the New York market closes in the hope that some magical buyer might appear, pay off our debts, and let us keep our jobs. But that doesn't happen, so we move our operations to life, where we sit in anxious silence around a table nibbling trail mix. Then somehow it is morning again, and cleaners in orange uniforms are hoovering about my feet. The day does not start well. Excelsior announced they will not roll over $100 million loan due to be repaid tomorrow. In New York, two sets of lawyers move into Agrobot HQ, one drafting documents for any potential third parties that might come forward with a rescue plan, the other preparing papers for bankruptcy. "And that's the good news," Gary McCrum says. "Word from Oran is that the Caliph has been overthrown." "Overthrown, dismembered, and fed to his own dogs," Gary clarifies.
"But how? Wasn't he in some hideout with his bodyguards?"
"It was the Imperial Guard that did it,"
Jürgen explains.
"Apparently they were unhappy about the extent of the Coalition's bombing campaign."
"And this has been verified?"
"See for yourself," Gary says. He takes out his phone and shows us a video of a bearded man weeping in terror as a carving knife is brought to his neck.
"Turn it off," mutters Ish.
"We have not spoken to the bodyguards,"
Jürgen says,
"but our sense is that the line of credit is no longer on the table."
"So what are our options?"
Jocelyn Lockhart asks.
"We don't have any options," Gary McCrum says grimly.
"We're finished."
"But we've done nothing wrong," Brent protests. "A whole bank can't go down because of a bunch of unsubstantiated rumors. It doesn't make any sense."
"Ordinarily, I would agree," Jürgen says. "However, the thing about these unsubstantiated rumors is that they are true. We have learned that among our recent acquisitions is several billion euros of now worthless Greek debt."
Stunned silence. Then, as Jürgen seems content to leave it there, somebody does the necessary,
"Why would we buy several billion euros of Greek debt?"
"That is an interesting question,"
Jürgen says, like a medical professor discussing an anatomical curiosity in a textbook.
"The answer seems to be that we did not know we were buying it. In a spirit of counterintuitiveness, it appears that due diligence was rushed through. Furthermore, this debt had been carefully concealed within several layers of shells, swaps, special purpose vehicles, like a computer virus that waits inside another file."
"Concealed by who?" Jocelyn says. "The Greek government."
They have always seemed too inept and lazy to come up with this kind of machination.
"Not exactly. If you remember, just before they joined the EU, the Greeks hired Dunforth Brouwer to cover up the enormous holes in their balance sheet."
Another silence. Jürgen smacks his lips together as if he has just enjoyed a particularly delicious snack. "So," slowly, Ish puts it together. "Danforth Brouwer took this toxic debt and hid it away, and then we came along and bought it."
"Someone else bought it, and then Agron bought them, and then we bought Agron,"
Jürgen says.
"All that glitters isn't gold,"
Kevin says, shaking his head.
"Porter's memo,"
he explains, seeing our baffled faces.
"That must be what he meant."
"Buying Agron was Porter's idea, you fool,"
Gary snaps.
"So?"
"So, if he had actually known it wasn't gold, surely he would have just not bought it, instead of sending everyone some unintelligible riddle about how we shouldn't buy it and then buying it."
"Maybe he was testing us,"
Kevin says.
"You know, like God."
"Wait a second," Ish says. "Porter was CEO of Danforth Brouwer. If Danforth's responsible for us buying a bunch of toxic crap that looks like it's going to drag us under, doesn't that mean that Porter's just pulled a huge con on Porter? He's basically bankrupted himself?"
"Fuck."
Jocelyn Lockhart rubs his jaw.
"Poetic justice. The great genius,"
Gary says sardonically.
"No wonder he's keeping his head down."
"It is true that the takeovers have not worked out exactly as planned,"
Jürgen says.
"However, it would be a mistake to write off Porter's strategy so soon. The very scale of Agrobot's impending collapse means that it cannot be allowed to happen. Thanks to his expansions, we are so big now that if we go down, an untold number of trading partners and counterparties will be pulled down with us, bringing the entire global banking system grinding to a halt. In a matter of hours, money will stop coming out of ATMs. In 2 or 3 days, there will be no food left on the supermarket shelves. By the end of the week, petrol will have run out, followed shortly by electricity. Within a month, the very fabric of civilization will have totally collapsed. We have seen in many movies what the consequences will be. Gangs of cannibals will rove the ruined highways. Families will shiver in the darkness of sewers. Strange millenarian cults will perform human sacrifices to artifacts once taken for granted by us, but now worshipped as gods. Ordinary public sector workers will now wear dog collars and mohawks and drive futuristic weaponized vehicles powered by paraffin. An endless metaphorical night will swallow the earth, although in practice the current diurnal system of sunrise and sunset should continue unaffected.
Somewhere in the middle of this, we have forgotten why it constitutes good news.
Because it means that the market has no choice but to refinance us.
Jürgen says with a shrill falsetto laugh.
Porto's acquisitions policy has been underwritten by nothing less than civilization itself. So you see, this is no more than the storm in a teacup. What is everyone so worried about?
He glides away, repeating this last phrase to himself like a mantra.
He's putting an awful lot of faith in this too-big-to-fail thing,
Jocelyn Lockhart says slowly.
Did I ever tell you about my Aunt Nilly?
He says.
She was always bragging that her tits were too big to fail. Every Saturday night she'd go out without so much as a lick of lippy on.
Don't need it, she'd say. Got these.
Then one day she was leaning over a fish pond and she fell in.
She drowned.
No, but when they brought her to emergency, that's where she met my Uncle Nick.
The morning grinds on, white-bitten and slow as a glacier. We sit stiff-backed at our desks, row upon row like children in some terrorized classroom. And whenever the lift doors open, we all whip round in unison, each expecting, though we don't admit it, to see a cohort of security guards troop out. Reynaldos, Esteban, Timoleon, the same surly men we've nodded to as they sat slouched in reception on so many mornings, now transformed, stalking through the office, distributing boxes, rousing us from our desks like stuporous, torpid jungle cats, who one day find the door to their cage left open and instantly reassume their true natures, the contempt in their eyes telling us everything we need to know.
We have enough capital to trade till the end of the day,
Liam English tries to make this sound positive.
And after that?
A circle of chalky faces like some ghostly Greek chorus.
After that, we'd be looking for either a buyout or a government intervention.
Except nobody wants to intervene, Jocelyn says.
What about civilization?
Kimberly asks.
The apocalypse. Don't they care about the apocalypse?
Liam explains that the market consensus is that Agrobot is not too big to fail after all, only almost too big to fail. A crucial difference.
So nobody's gonna die,
Gary says. Liam shakes his head.
But tomorrow's casual day, Kimberly says sadly. We can't close on casual day, it's always such a laugh.
Casual day would be one of the less significant movers of global capitalism,
Liam tells her.
And where's Porter in the middle of all this?
Brent Kelleher erupts.
Hasn't he got anything to say? Shouldn't he give some bloody account of himself before they send him off into the sunset with his $50 million severance package?
There's not a lot Porter can do,
Liam says.
If there's going to be a rescue, it'll have to come from the outside.
So it's back to the wait. Dave Davison reads the racing pages. Thomas Ewan McGregor arranges pebbles on his mouse mat. Knots of panic become interfused with a weird, blissed-out lethargy, the kind of lightheadedness you would get when the oxygen is running out. From the window, I can see the shutters are down on the ark, making it look like a sarcophagus. I keep imagining Ariadne is trapped inside. Have to stop myself from running to help.
3 feet high and rising, I called,
Ish says.
What?
The river. Below, filthy water is frothing ever closer to street level. The Liffey has never burst its banks. This is what I hear people telling each other in supermarket queues.
Yeah, well, banks have been known to fail, haven't they?
She doesn't sound overly concerned. In fact, she's been quite blithe since the prospect of Agrobot's imminent destruction emerged, possibly because Skylark Fitzgibbon and all mention of golf courses disappeared around the same time. This seems disloyal. I feel a surge of anger, but before I can say anything, Kimberly appears and hands me a piece of paper.
Facts for you, Claude.
You don't have to keep bringing them, I say, but she's already gone. Someone still loves you, I, Claude, Ish says, pinching my arm. Mike Purzel comes running in.
Barclays is looking into a buyout!
Everyone jumps out of their seats and crowds around him. Then Liam English comes out of his office, and they leave Mike and gather around him instead. Liam confirms that Barclays has made contact. Cheers resound through the room.
Talks are at a preliminary stage,
Liam warns, but he doesn't object to following further developments from the pub.
Are you coming?
Ish is halfway out the door. In a minute. I remain at the window, looking at the fax in my hand. At the top, somebody has carefully printed FAO Claude Martingale. Then follows the now familiar block of assiduous blackness. It occurs to me that instead of an attempt to use up ink, you could read it if you wanted as a story. The story of Claude, the real one, with which the version I'd hoped for, Ariadne, love, adventure, all that, has been overwritten. Because even if a buyout materializes and the bank is saved, the Ark will still be gone, won't it? And Ariadne with it, leaving with me nothing but the present, the never-ending present, on which to inscribe myself over and over in letters that are skyscraper high. A man is standing in our office. Stubby, mustachioed, he stares directly at me. Where have I seen him before? Looking for Howard Hogan, he says. He speaks in an even, courteous tone, but specks of sweat glisten on his temples, and the brilliant white collar of his shirt digs deep into his pink neck.
It is the man we saw when Ish and I visited Howie's fund, I realize. The chortling fellow who left the bag full of banknotes. Upstairs, I say, jabbing at the ceiling. 9th floor.
Doesn't seem to be anyone there, the man says. His tone remains steady, but his eyes boggle at me, seize me by the lapels, and shake me.
I'm afraid I can't help you, I tell him. This is Agron Torabundo Bank. Agron Torabundo Credit Management is a separate enterprise.
He stares at me another moment, then seems to wilt. A merchant prince stripped of his belongings, lost among savages. A door opens, and in rush the two burly men who accompanied him on the 9th floor that day. He raises his eyebrows. They shake their heads. He emits a low gurgle as if inside him something were being throttled. Without another word, he turns on his heel and heads for the lobby, phone pressed to his ear. When he is gone, I climb the stairwell to the 9th floor. A fire extinguisher has been used to break down the door. Inside, the beautiful artwork is gone, as well as most of the furniture. None of the staff seems to be here either, though a residue of panic remains etched in the air, conjuring images of rushing bodies, boxes hastily filled. On Howie's desk, an empty bottle of whiskey sits by a sticky glass. One edge of the keyboard is sprinkled with powder. I touch a key and the screen comes to life, a game of Tetris, colored blocks piled claustrophobically all the way to the top. The ledgers that line the shelf on the back wall are all empty, the drawers likewise, except for a pair of pink panties and a biography of Steve Jobs. I find myself thinking of Paul's red notebook, page after page, filled with cartoon penises. Hearing a noise, I leave the room and turn a corner to find Tom Kremins and Brian O'Brien hard at work, one feeding documents into the shredder, the other smashing up hard drives with a hammer. They look up momentarily, but don't speak to me. Beyond them is a wall safe, empty. Beside the safe is another door. No one answers when I knock. In fact, there is no sense the room has ever been occupied. No files, no phone, no stationery or computer clutter the beautiful maple desk. The softest veil of dust lies over everything, like a protective covering. In the corner, however, is a large cupboard. On a hunch, I turn the handle.
Go away,
Grisha says. What are you doing in here? The closet is just big enough for a mop and bucket, on the latter of which the quant is sitting.
Maths, you are not understanding.
On the walls?
His shoulders snap up and down. I gaze around me at the algorithmic scroll that covers the cupboard's interior. Even the ceiling has been inscribed with tiny pinched print, and with a shiver I think again of the Tixier painting. The proliferation of minute brushstrokes, tiny bricks in a huge altarpiece to nothing.
Everyone's gone, I say.
Howie, everyone.
He ignores this, continues his calculations.
The fun's finished, I tell him,
and when he doesn't respond to this either, push a little harder.
It was a fraud, a Ponzi scheme. I imagine the money Howie paid out to the investors
was the money he was getting from new clients. Everything else he took for himself. Screech Scratch goes the pen, filling the wall with infinitesimal signs.
He didn't use your model, I say gently. Do you understand? You, your providential antinomies, you were just props. None of it was real.
None of this is reality.
Grisha rejoins with an impatient wave at everything outside the cupboard.
Only this. He taps vehemently on the walls with his pen.
The instrument?
He scowls, scrubs his shaggy head, muttering under his breath. Then, twisting quickly as if he is about to rise and strike me, he says in a high, querulous voice,
"You people are thinking you can use maths like slave to this, to that. I laugh at you. You are like shadows who think they can direct the sun."
He stops, looks over my shoulder. Someone is standing in the doorway. It's Howie's Bulgarian dealer. In his hand is an ice pick. We don't move, we don't even breathe. He has lost his sunglasses. For a long moment he stares at us with incomprehensible eyes, then he turns away. A moment later, from down the hall, we hear rampaging noises, terrorized cries.
"Come to life," I tell Grisha. "It's not safe here."
"Life?"
Grisha repeats mockingly.
"Everyone's down there."
"Dance while you can, little shadow,"
he says softly, returning to his equations.
"Dance in the light."
Agrobot staff are the only customers in Life Bar. The semi-darkness and sticky floors seem a better fit for us in our degraded state than Transaction House.
"Claude, Claude!"
Liam English, far drunker than their short time in the pub would seem to allow, half stands to greet me.
"Asseyez-vous, Claude. What'll you have?"
Pulling a wad of notes from his pocket, he stumbles off without waiting for an answer.
"Check it out, Claude."
Justin Lockhart points at the plasma screen on the wall.
"Mars has been taken in for questioning."
The screen shows the silver-haired head of Royal Irish jauntily strolling into a police station, where the newsreader informs us sonorously he will be questioned for up to 36 hours.
"New minister making his presence felt,"
Dave Davison comments.
"Bollocks,"
Joe Piston says.
"Miles is sat in there watching Home and Away while the coppers bring him fish and chips. It's all just a show for the little people."
"I can't believe that that fucking clip joint is still trading and we're going under," Gary McCrum says darkly.
"Maybe Porter should have moved the HQ to Ireland,"
Jocelyn says.
"Fuck Porter."
"Here, Claude, have you seen Howie?"
Ish asks me.
"There were some people in here looking for him."
I shake my head, ask what's happening with Barclays.
"Nada," Gary says. "They're still in talks, so I'm not holding my breath." "I heard Porter's not even there,"
Dave says.
"It's that little guy again, the co-global head of whatever."
"I'll say this for Porter, he's a cool customer," Justin sighs, topping up his beer.
"His bank goes down the tubes and he doesn't break a sweat. I mean, he must have a ton of preferred stock, right? What's that going to cost him? And he's still nowhere to be found."
At this, Ish starts. Then she sinks slowly back into a chair, her expression somewhere between perplexity and horror, as if she's struggling with some demonic conundrum whose solution leads straight to the charnel house. On the TV over her head, the news cycles on. A car burning in a street in Oran, the new Irish finance minister announcing 4 new jobs at a toilet brush factory, floods in Bangladesh, in Prague, in Cork, the Agrobot press conference again with the caption, "Death, look at the upside." The sun begins to set. More bodies appear in the doorway's pocket of golden dusk, and with the same half-ironical, half-hopeless smile, make their way over to our table. Traders, analysts, salesmen, back-office people I've never spoken to, people whose names I don't even know. The eschatological atmosphere, the sense that beyond our little ring of survivors, illuminated now by candles the barman has set down on the grouped tables, darkness prevails, brings to mind those medieval books in which a small band of travellers, fleeing plague or disaster, take refuge in a way station and pass the night exchanging tales. "Remember the time the fire alarm went off, and then when we went back inside, it went off again?
Remember that intern how he kept giving extra accounts to, and he took all that meth and tried to jump out the window? Remember the time the fire alarm went off? Says Tocqueil Quinn, just arrived, taking off his scarf. And then when we went back inside, it went off again. He is surprised by the muted reception this gets. Well, look it, Dave Davison sums up. Whatever happens, we can't complain. We had a good run of it. Agrobot is a great bank. Liam English concurs emotionally, prodding the table with his index finger so the glasses shake. A great bloody bank, and if it goes down because we had the guts to take a chance and do things counterintuitively, there's no shame in that. Then, noticing through his whiskey fog that this hasn't had the galvanizing effect he intended, though it won't go down, he adds. I've been thinking about moving on anyway, Joe Piston says. Maybe it's time to give something back. Heads nod and the conversation turns to restoring old boats, teaching underprivileged children other long-cherished dreams whose hour may at last have come. Then Liam English's phone rings. Instantly silence falls across the table. Liam makes a show of indifference, looking at the number, appearing to think it over. Rachel? He says, picking it up at last. Yeah? Okay. Right. Okay, Grant, I will. Yes, okay. He puts the phone down, lifts his glass, sips, gasps with satisfaction. Finally, he becomes aware of the many eyes staring at him. So Barclays have passed, he says. There is an audible collective gasp, followed by a long, wintry nothing. So that's it? Jocelyn Lockhart says bitterly. I just bought a Jaguar, Brent Kelleher moans. Now I'm going to be one of those people who go around the supermarket checking which is the cheapest muesli.
There could still be a buyout,
Derry Fusco pleads.
Like, by someone else?
Who's going to be dumb enough to buy $8 billion worth of radioactive Greek shit? On the TV screen over the bar, the new finance minister, toilet brush in hand, perorates soundlessly from a podium. Around our table, too, silence reigns. No one mentions the underprivileged or boat restoration. Fuck it, Dave Davison exclaims. We can't spend our last fucking night sitting round feeling sorry for ourselves. You're right, Gary McCrum joins in. We're Agrobot. If we're gonna go down, we should do it in style. VDs, let's roll. In the blink of an eye, we are in our coats, the prospect of one last blowout on expenses lending us superhuman speed. I catch Ishi's eye. She shrugs, not wanting to go home any more than I do, and gathers up her belongings. Gary waves his hand superfluously at a long line of static cabs and topples into the one at the top. Ish and I pile into the back seat of the next one, Kevin into the front.
Follow that car, he says, pointing.
The driver, African, heavy set, regards me questioningly in the mirror, but doesn't speak. As soon as we're off, Ish grips my arm, leans into me and says in a low, urgent voice, something about this isn't right. Huh? Think about it. If we didn't know we were carrying all this Greek debt, how did anyone else find out? Huh? I say again. The rumours, where did they come from? Someone spread the story around to drive down our share price, but if Demforth had parcelled up the Greek debt and hidden it so cleverly that even our own due diligence didn't spot it, who could that have been? Alcohol sloshes around in my brain, and weariness and grief, all of them crying out against yet more abstraction. But Ish is insistent. It would have been someone who knew what Danforth had done, right?
Such as who?
Such as, for instance, Danforth's former CEO.
This wakes me up.
What are you saying?
Porter started the rumors? Doesn't it make sense? He knows Agron's unwittingly carrying a ton of toxic securities. He buys them out for fuck all and sends our share price through the roof. Then he puts it about that we're carrying the debt. The whole deal is set up for one colossal short.
That would be insider trading. I'll say. It'll be the greatest insider trade of all time. What would he make from it? Tens of millions? More?
Potter wouldn't bring down his own bank.
Wouldn't he? For $100 million?
He's got 10 times that in stock options.
Maybe he did it for $1 billion then.
Or, a fresh thought strikes her.
Maybe he's got a plan to save the bank once he's pulled off his short, meaning he can cash in twice. You're crazy, I tell her and turn to the window. Porter makes billions, someone else makes billions, it's legitimate, it's not, who cares? Who cares about any of it? We continue in silence for a moment. In the passenger seat, Kevin is telling the taxi driver how much he enjoys black music. I hear the art close down, Ish says. Yes, weird coincidence. Probably for the best, she says, placing her hand on mine. Don't you think? You mean because of my unrequited love? I mean, it feels like all of this. Maybe it came at the right time. We have a chance to get out now while we're still young. Do something with our lives. Restore old boots. Something that actually helps people.
Personally, I'm skeptical about the helping people thing. Kevin pipes up from the front. The whole, look at me, I'm such a good person bit. We could all spend our lives scrubbing oil off fucking seagulls, you know. But where would that get the world, ultimately? If everybody was altruistic, there literally wouldn't be anyone left to help. And meanwhile, all the stuff that needed to be done wouldn't get done.
I take it you're planning to stay in banking, Ish says.
Society needs selfish people, Kevin says. We're the ones who keep the whole thing moving forward anyway. You can't change who you are. If you're a boa constrictor, there's no use trying to be a sheepdog. There's no sense in saying, oh, I'm tired of choking small animals to death. Instead, I think I'll round up sheep for a living. It just won't work.
There is a honk. From the taxi in front, Dave Davison and Mike Purzel are mooning us. Kevin Chortles gives them the finger. I don't think of you as a boa constrictor, I tell Ish. Thanks, Claude. Though what about your mortgage if you are planning on helping people? Ish considers this. Sometimes I wonder if I just got that mortgage so I didn't have to ask myself why I was working in some shitty bank. The car inches through the traffic in fits and starts. Rain deluges the windscreen, rain slicks the streets, rain has taken over this town like a mafia gang rolled in from some nightmare metropolis. What about you, Claude? A street lamp in the window gives her a momentary rain-diffused halo. What will you do? I don't know what I will do. I don't have a plan or an ideal to pursue. My love story is over. After tomorrow, the bank will be gone too, and I will probably never see any of these people again. And there will be no sign that the last 2 years ever happened. Apart from the money, of course. The money will still be there, piled up in my account, like those towers of hoarded newspapers they find in old people's houses after they die. I suppose I will look for another position. I say, I hear Goldman are looking. I am conscious of her disapproval, but for a moment she doesn't speak. The backseat silence is filled by the slur of the tires on the wet street, the muffled thrum of the city. On Kokomoko they have this legend, she says at last, of a tribe that left the gift circle. And this tribe, every time they go out in their boats, they catch a full net of fish, and every time they dive to the seabed, they find the most beautiful shells, and every time they fight in battle, they win. And if you're starving, or you need allies for a war, or a necklace for a dowry, in the middle of the night, these tribesmen will appear at your bedside, and they'll offer you whatever you want. But the thing is, once you take it, you'll never be able to pay them back. Your food, your positions, the clothes on your back, they'll keep coming and coming in the middle of the night, and sooner or later they'll take your mother, your daughter, your whole family, carry them away to their island that no one ever returns from. Shh, shh, go the wipers on the windscreen. Traffic light red dazzles over the glass. The anthropologists think it's got its roots in history. The slavers used to sail out from Turubondo around the archipelago trying to get the islanders to take on loans, particularly if the fish catch was down. The islanders didn't really understand what loans were. They were used to just giving each other what they needed, so they fell into these enormous debts. The slavers would take their children as security until they paid them back, and their parents and never see them again. So these legends arose sort of like warnings. If you leave the gift circle, if you take the zombie gold, then you're already dead. Leaning forward, she taps the driver on the shoulder. Let me out here, please. I do not conceal my dismay. Aren't you coming to Vidis? She shakes her head. Have a lap dance for me, eh? See you tomorrow for the grand finale. She steps out into the rain. The door shuts and the taxi shrieks back into motion. Kevin cranes his head around.
I'll tell you one thing I won't miss. That story's about those sodding islanders. Some bunch of oddballs who don't even wear trousers telling us we're dead.
He turns back to the front.
When I'm dead, you'll know about it, he says. You can expect a very volatile market that day, my friend.
From the basement door, red lights flash and a deep percussive rumbling issues. All right, mate. The bouncer checks me with his hand. Where are you coming from?
Life,
I tell him.
Oh, yeah?
He scrutinizes Kevin and me with pale hobgoblin eyes.
Our colleagues are inside, I say. Agron Torabundo?
His eyes narrow. I wonder momentarily if he is one of our shareholders.
Tell your pals in there to cool it, he says.
The whole of Agrobot seems to be downstairs, sweat rings under their armpits, faces simultaneously grinning and aghast, like soldiers on furlough from some terrible war. Kevin prods me, points to where Jürgen is waving at us from a table.
You have made it at last!
He hollers as we stumble out of the melee.
I am thinking you will never be coming.
He appears oddly relaxed, even jovial, as if we were at our Christmas party. He shunts along the banquette so we can squeeze in beside him, orders us drinks from a passing nymph. Chris Kane is at the table as well, telling the fire alarm story to some people from sales. Around us, the mood has intensified from gloom into a kind of morbid bacchanal. Champagne bottles peck the tables like skittles, suited figures process continuously to the bathroom in twos and threes, while others are led away by silver-knickered houris to the cubicles at the back of the club. House beats pound at my body. I take a bottle from the nymph's tray, debate interiorly as to whether or not I should stay, and then...
Something wrong, Claude!
I thought I saw... It feels almost too absurd to say out loud. But as the mass of bodies around us reconfigures itself, just for a second the face reemerges.
Who?
Porter.
Porter?
Jürgen's laughter is more kindly than mocking.
I think perhaps in life bar you are drinking many Jägerbombs.
He's right, I think. And then the crowd kaleidoscopes again, and once more I see him, by a little door in the distant corner, as if on his way in or out. The light is dim and people keep getting in the way, but how can it be anyone else? The snow-white hair, the golden skin, the famous jawline that has triumphed in innumerable boardroom battles. And the man he is deep in talk with, don't I know him too? Small, spry, silver-haired, a gleam in his eye. Isn't that Miles O'Connor?
I am not seeing either of them!
Pushing Jürgen aside, I jump from my seat and hurry towards the corner. As I get closer, it seems other figures flicker out of the darkness. The little Portuguese man who had haunted the minister. And there isn't that Howie? And Walter? But my way is blocked again and again, colleagues stepping in front of me to clasp me in beery embraces or take my picture with their phones. And by the time I reach the corner, neither Porter nor Miles nor any of the others is anywhere to be seen. A trick of the light, after all. Shoulders slumping, I come to a halt. Around me, fragments of conversations flurry, memories jousting with each other in loud, unhearing voices. Down the stairs, men continue to come, surveying the scene with identical expressions of childlike avarice. The nymphs thread through them, bearing order pads and trays of drinks, pushed-up breasts and intoxicating smiles. A dark-haired dancer has come on stage, the girl who looks like Ariadne. I pause to watch her grind her crutch against the pole, a mechanical siren delivering her one-note song. It was a mistake to come here. The night has nothing more to offer. I decide to cut my losses, make my way to the exit. And then I see someone indisputably real. So, at least one mystery has been solved tonight. I follow at a distance, watching the figure weave through the crowd, then come to rest in a niche close by the warren of private booths. Where, thinking herself unobserved, she sighs, arches her back, and rolls her head. Marching briskly up to her, I tap her on the shoulder. No volleyball tonight? She spins around, and I recoil. An enormous contusion, a swollen rainbow of purples and greens, adorns one side of her face.
What are you doing here?
The words come in a gasp.
Is he here too?
She casts desperately around the room, her hands frenetically hopping up and down over her bare flesh as if they could cover it up one piece at a time. It's just me. I assure her, I am here with my work colleagues. Her breathing eases, her eyes lift to scan mine.
So you do not go to festival, she says.
Festival? Clitia waits, puffed eye lowering at me, then lightens sardonically as she sees the realization hit me. Of course. Tonight is the first night of the Black and White Festival. William O'Hara is interviewing Bimal Banerjee as we speak. And Robert Dodson is waiting in the wings to discuss Paul's book proposal. Oh, I say, trying to gauge from her expression what he told her, what I need to say here. Yes, I was going to go with him, but there has been a crisis at work. She flaps a hand at me dismissively.
Don't bother, Frenchman.
He could have gone by himself, I point out. I've been too busy at work to get in touch with him. He told you he was going to meet Dodson.
Oh, he tells me a lot of things, wonderful things. This very morning he says that tonight he does something big, a new plan that will change everything.
Well then, that must be what he meant. I tell her I have not seen him for a little while, but that I know he's been working hard on the proposal and it must be nearly finished.
It will never be finished, Frenchman, she says, cutting me off. There will never be a book. I have fooled myself with his hope 100 times.
She looks at me dully.
All this week he does not even look at his desk, doesn't lift up a pen, just drinks with that idiot Igor.
But then why would he tell you? Why?
Because he's a liar.
The bitter smile drops, and it seems that her whole face is suffused with the shadow of the wounded eye.
That is what he does, Frenchman. He lies. If he wrote his lies down, he would have enough for 50 books. But he is too afraid to lift the pen.
Her face becomes stone.
All of this time I have been the fool who believes him. No more.
Her tone is bleak, final. I cast about desperately for some means of defending him. What about you? I say. When is the last time you told him the truth? Clitia shrugs her beautiful shoulders. She has stopped looking at me, instead scans the crowd for customers, as the crowd simultaneously slows to appraise her. Most men recoil when they catch sight of her black eye, but not all of them do.
Where have you told him you are tonight?
She doesn't reply, directs a salacious smile at the corporate type who has paused at the edge of our conversation. He gulps, takes out his wallet, fingers through it, moves on. Her smile inverts, her brow becoming thunderous. She insinuates herself into the throng, with me bumbling after. How long have you been working here?
Leave me alone.
Who did that to your face?
It's not important.
Was it?
Don't be ridiculous.
But he's seen it. Doesn't he know? Hasn't he guessed?
I believe his lies, so he believes mine.
She turns and looks at me straight on.
That's how it goes at the end of love.
She walks away, I grab her elbow. Instantly a bouncer bristles mastiff-like from the shadows. At some imperceptible signal from Clitia, he withdraws again.
You are costing me money,
she says coldly. Alors, how much? I reach into my pockets. How much does it cost to be alone with you?
Private dance, 50 euro.
I hand her a note. She takes it without comment. Jocelyn Lockhart and Gary McCrum spot me from the bar and cheer. My cheeks burn. I do my best not to look at her as she leads me back to the booths. The room is small and cramped. A red light comes on as she closes the door. She backs me into an uncomfortable chair, stands over me like a robot Amazon.
5 minutes. What do you want me to do for you?
Tell me the truth.
What for?
I want to help you.
I don't need your help.
It looks like you do.
This is just temporary.
Who did that to you?
Club boss.
Why?
Because I borrow money, then I don't come to work.
When Paul was writing his book proposal?
You are wasting your 50 euro, Frenchman. The truth is the least interesting thing about me.
Why did you come back to the club?
You have seen how we live.
You had a job.
I lost it.
But this dancing, you hate it. He told me.
His commercial transaction. Very soon I have enough to leave.
Leave the club? She smiles. She knows I know that is not what she means. My heart plunges in a spiral. Where will you go?
Home.
with Remington?
Of course.
I prop my elbows on my knees, scrub my head with my hands. I wish you'd told me about this before. I can help you. I have money. It's the only thing I do have.
Oh, Claude.
She stops short, brings her slender fingers to her heart.
Would you really do that for me? You are a special man, very special man.
She draws closer till her breasts are hovering inches from my nose.
Maybe I can think of a special way to repay you,
she whispers.
A secret just between us two?
Stop, I mutter. She reels away with a leer of barren triumph.
The hero with his shining wallet,
she says.
This club is full of men who want to help me, Frenchman.
Exasperated, I rise from the chair. She flinches back theatrically as if I had moved against her. I sit back again, say carefully, I know you have made many sacrifices, and I know your husband has failed you many times, but I am asking you to give him just one more chance. I am sure that this time, with a little help, he can finish this book.
The book?
She throws her hands in the air.
You are the same as him. I don't care about the book. I don't care if he writes another fucking word. I just want him to be here in the world with me, be here with his son instead of walking around like the dead man.
He loves you. She flicks her hand as at some insignificant noise.
He does,
I insist.
He told me. He loves me and he drinks our money,
she exclaims.
He loves me and eviction notice comes. He loves me and I listen to my little boy's tummy rumble all night long.
She draws back. The bruised flesh around her eye pulsates with loathing.
What do you know about it anyway, little lonely Frenchman with your sad dreams of true love? What do you know about love or truth? You sit in your palace of death, buying and selling human souls. You don't even look out the window to see the world you make us live in.
You are wrong. I do look out. I see what you have and I envy it. The cliché is true. There are some things money can't buy.
Money can't buy anything real,
Clitzia says. You have not always believed that. She pulls up, looks at me aslant with an ironical smile. Even in silence, the force of her rage hits me like a gale.
It is true. Perhaps in each of us there is a little Frenchman who sighs and knots his fingers and gazes at sunset. When I was young, I have lots of dreams. I dream of escaping my shit old town. I dream of marrying an artist and never think about money. I follow my dreams and I end up on a stage showing my pussy to drunks.
She pulls indifferently at a banknote that still protrudes from her G-string, looks up at me with false merriment.
That is how it goes, Frenchman. We dream our dreams and we take our pay and the world turns to shit.
There is a click and the light comes on.
Time's up,
she says. I go up at her, floundering, then fumble out my wallet. I have no cash left. She looks at me coolly as she might at any other of her clients, priapic, in love with her, desperate to prolong the fraudulent moment. Please, I entreat her. You must promise me that before you do anything, you will let me talk to him.
I have to go, Clitzia says.
You can't give up yet, just wait a little bit longer. Standing in the doorway, shot through by shafts of light from the dance floor, she appears fissiparous, disintegrating.
Go home, Frenchman, she says. This is not your story.
She turns away and is swallowed instantly by the nebula darkness. I hurry out after her, but at the door I'm seized by Gary and Jocelyn and Dave Davison.
Have you heard, Claude? There's a rescue package! We're still alive!
Their faces swing about me like carnival masks, repeating the same words. Government, last minute, royal. But I'm too addled to make sense of them. All I can think is that I must find Paul at once. To the sound of champagne corks popping, I climb the stairs and out onto the street. Just as I flag down a cab, though, I remember that I gave the last of my cash in my wallet to Clitzia. I search about my pockets frantically and at last dig something out. and freeze there on the side of the road.
Are you getting in or not?
The driver wants to know. Sorry. I wave numbly. He swears and pulls away again. I remain at the curb staring at the paper in my hand. Not a banknote, but the fax from earlier today. It nests in my palm, a sheet of perfect black, and Krizia's words resound in my ears. This very morning he tells me that tonight he does something big, a new plan that will change everything. A terrible thought springs out of the darkness. What if this time he was telling the truth?